Hi, I'm Steph.
I'm Kim.
And this is Solved, Unsolved, or Spooky.
Hey, Kim.
Hey. How's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm awesome.
I'm good.
So, you got any news to tell?
Well, we did witness a stabbing last week.
We certainly did.
Interesting.
You want to elaborate?
Well, there was this guy and this other guy, and he asked the first guy not to swear because there was kids around, and then the other dude decided that was a stab-worthy offence and started trying to stab him.
It was indeed.
It was. Crazy.
And the perpetrator is...
going to court.
Yeah, he is. And the guy that got stabbed?
He's okay.
That's good.
Stitches in his arm, but he should be fine.
As you all know, this is our first podcast and it's our first episode. There probably will be a few glitches, a few little mistakes here and there.
I am editing, so probably.
Yeah, Kim's editing, so expect horror. We will get better. Just bear with us and eventually we will be amazing.
We will be covering cases that are either solved, unsolved, or something that is spooky. So, stay tuned.
Just listen every week and we will continue to entertain you. All right. Who's going first today?
You are. And what case are you covering?
So I'm doing the cowboy serial killer who never rode a horse.
Sounds interesting.
Yep. Okay. So who is this awful bag of horse poop, I hear you ask?
Who indeed?
His name is Reginald Tex Arthur. He frequented the Outback rodeos. He dressed like a cowboy, always wearing a cowboy hat, a belt and a cowboy buckle, jeans and, as you get, cowboy boots. Always looking the part, but never striding the back of a horse.
That sounds weird for a cowboy.
Loser. Always a chameleon, playing the part, something he was not. He couldn't even stick with one name. Always playing the part of what he wanted to be in the moment. Role suckers, Robert the Drifter, working as a chef in a hotel on the long, lonely road in the outback, or one of his many aliases, Hank or Buck, or any of the other 200 he adopted.
How does anyone have 200? Like, I forget how old I am, and I only have to remember one. Like, not 200.
This guy hardly ever held down a job. He didn't have much to worry about.
Okay.
So Reginald was a tall man of 2 metres, with a strong build. Dorky man. He blended into any background. He could talk himself into and out of all kinds of situations.
Sounds handy for a criminal.
Usually the bad kind.
Yep.
His self-importance, ego and narcissistic personality were always at the centre of his vicious crimes. 25-year-old Arthurl was named as a major suspect in the vicious and unexplained murder of 82-year-old Catherine Mary Page, also known to locals, families and friends as Kate, a beautiful church-going lady who was bashed to death in her Canamble home at the height of the 1971 floods.
That sounds a little excessive.
A bit unfair.
Bashing someone.
82-year-old lady.
Okay, because that seems warranted.
Yeah. She was found face down in a pool of blood on her kitchen floor. Yeah. Her head and shoulders are reported to have been bashed with a blunt object. This has also been reported to be the butt of a rifle. Once again, loser. It was rumoured that this was probably Arthur's first murder, and he was in the locality, visiting a friend around the corner from Kate's home. He was already known to police with a list of convictions for vagrancy, dishonesty, and possessing an unlicensed pistol.
A lot of things.
It's also reported that he'd escaped police by cross-dressing.
He must have looked pretty.
I bet he did. Cold case detectives thought they had a breakthrough when items they believed belonged to Mrs. Page, with some head hairs, were handed into them. However, the various rounds of DNA testing showed nothing. So Arthur got off on that one, if he, in fact, did commit the murder.
Mm.
From what I've read.
Yeah.
Police are eager to catch her killer and have posted a $100,000 reward. So if you know anything, please call Crime Stoppers on 1-800-333-000 and please help give Kate's family the closure they deserve. This case is not... It would be great, hey? Yeah. How good would it be to get him on another charge. Another one, yeah. It would be awesome. And especially you'll find out why at the end of the podcast. This case is not closed and Chief Inspector John Lehman is eager to find any new information that may lead to a conviction. Well, part two of the scumbag. After drifting around the towns of northern and western Australia and working in a hotel and hospital in Derby, a roadhouse in Fitzroy Crossing and on cattle stations in Derby, in May 1974, as a beautiful boy he is, he decided to visit his mother in Sydney.
Sounds like it's going to go well.
During his visit, he ran into his ex-stepfather.
Yep.
Happy days, Thomas Thornton. Thornton invited Reg back to his home in Guildford.
Don't do it.
Where the stepfather was later found stabbed viciously to death.
Oh, God.
Reginald had only been 28 when he killed his stepfather, who was 49 at the time of his death. The weapon was later determined to be a carving knife after the cowardly Reginald Tex Arthur went on the run. Coward.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I was unable to find any further information on the victim of this terrible crime.
Oh, I was about to ask why he decided to kill his stepfather.
Which is really sad. Mm. Well, I don't know why, and it's really sad that I don't have any information about the stepfather, because it should be his story that's being told. Anyway, the chameleon drifted north, working at rodeos in northern New South Wales and Queensland, where he impersonated American cowboys and sporadically took on odd jobs at outback stations, making it hard for the police to catch up with him. So outback Australia is so arid and desolate. Is a good
beautiful,
word.
Though.
It's beautiful, but it's so sparse. And back 20, 30 years ago with no internet.
You could disappear.
You could disappear, mm-hmm. especially if you've got 200 aliases.
Which I still don't know how anyone keeps up with that many.
And ride an invisible horse. So in 1981, whilst on the run from the law, Reginald met up with another man and they decided to rob a young 19-year-old sailor who kindly had given them a lift. In November of 81, Ross Browning was found with massive head wounds. His mutilated and partially decomposed body was found off the Barclay Highway in Scrub, 35 kilometres east of Tennant Creek.
Okay.
Yep. The Northern Territory Police described this awful waste of life as the most vicious they had investigated.
Especially such as someone so young.
Yeah, what a waste of life. It was later found that Arthur used a piece of anthill to beat the young officer to death.
An anthill.
Yep.
A legit anthill.
They make them tough in Australia.
Like, did he just, like, grab it out of, like, the... Like, or was it, like, already broken?
I don't know. They didn't report on that, but...
What about the anthill?
Like, smashed him in the head with an anthill.
Okay.
I was also sadly unable to find any further information regarding this young man's life that was taken so early. Queensland police also wanted to question Reginald over the Wolf Creek-style murders of three backpackers near Mount Isa in 1978. Karen Edwards, Tim Thompson and Gordon Twaddle, who were found barbarically shot to death. The killer did not even try to cover his crime. He shot his victims with a .22 caliber rifle, stripped them of any ID and emptied their pockets, leaving them to decompose in the searing Australian outback sun.
Oh, God.
You know how hot that gets? Yes. In the 40 degrees, and we're talking Celsius. Very, very hot. They were found by a couple walking their greyhounds. They were all still dressed, and Edwards was partly covered by a piece of tin. However, there has since been an arrest in this case. Police have taken a Goulburn man named Bruce John Preston, age 63, has been charged with three counts of murder. So I can only assume that Reginald was not involved in this one.
Yeah.
Later, in 1981, Arthur was arrested at the Corn Cob Hotel in Mareeba, where he pleaded guilty to manslaughter and received a reduced sentence.
Of course.
Arthur was released after serving only 6.5 years of the light 12-year sentence that he'd been given for this horrific and tragic murder of such a young man.
Wow, that's crazy.
Incredible, isn't it?
That's insane.
New South Wales detectives extradited him to Sydney to face charges relating to the killings of his stepfather, Thomas Thornton, this time on the grounds of provocation. And in July 1989, he was jailed for a minimum piffly term of 4.5 years.
That seems enough. Like, well, you only murdered someone.
The second person.
I was going to say, his second person.
With a maximum period of 11 years. Mm. Arthur will only serve 23 months for this crime.
I'm sure he's rehabilitated.
Not. No, he is. You'll hear about that in a minute.
Oh, I'm sure.
Justice Peter McInerney remarked on Arthur's remarkable transformation after he'd been baptised in a Darwin jail.
Yep. I'll do it.
Yep. My question to this is, if this fixes everyone and everything, why don't we just baptise everyone in jail and let them all out? Lucky we didn't, because it gets worse. So the newly reformed, baptised, born-again, perfect citizen of the community was released as early as April 1991. During Reginald's time in jail, he was fortunate enough to meet a beautiful, kind and loving Christian prison visitor named Vinette Raylene Mulhall, aged a young 54 at the time. She took pity on him and started writing to him in Darwin jail.
Mm-hmm.
She was a beautiful woman, a mother. She sounds beautiful. She had some stuff going on in her own life. She'd had a brain tumour. She had that removed and it had damaged her face.
Crazy.
Yeah, so her face was
a bit disfigured.
Disfigured on one side. It was, yeah. But she took him in and,
yeah
terrible. She took pity on him and started writing to him in jail. The filthy chameleon once again changed its colours to fit into a situation.
I just keep picturing a chameleon in cowboy boots and a cowboy hat. I hope every time you say that.
I hope he's ugly. Okay. She got engaged to him. She purchased a home for them to share together as husband and wife. Unfortunately for Vinette, the system let her down. One of the release conditions was that this murderous monster be released into the care of this gentle, kind and caring lady. Their brief engagement ended in the most tragic circumstances possible, when Vinette's brother, Mr. Quinn, found his sister's body, bashed and decomposing, in her Coonabarabran home. It is reported that Arthur had killed her because she would not give him her car.
That's insane. And to find your own sister like that.
Yeah.
No way.
Absolutely awful. You think he would have just taken the car.
I was going to say, like, it's a car. You don't murder someone over a car.
Another waste of life.
At all, but.
The murder weapon was a piece of wood. Vinette's brother wrote the following after finding her body. Quote, "As I climbed through the window, I knew the foul smell, that I was entering a horrendous situation and that I was looking for a decomposing body," Mr. Quinn wrote. "As the edge of the door passed through my gaze, I could see what I at first thought was a black plastic garbage bag propped up against the door jamb." End of quote. If you're interested in reading the rest of this statement, please purchase the book titled In the Hands of Evil, about his sister's life and death, written by Miss Mulhall's brother, Paul Quinn.
Sounds like an interesting read.
I think it would be a very interesting read.
Just hear it from his point.
Yeah. Yet again, this monster was convicted for another murder, but still not jailed for life.
Crazy.
Absolutely crazy. Third time.
You think the first one would have been enough?
Third conviction. Crazy.
Mental.
Apparently this murder was not considered to be in the worst case category.
Okay. What is that?
What would be the worst case category?
I don't know. Like, to me, murdering, at least, like, you know, one person, little one, three would be enough.
Okay. Viciously with a piece of wood. And Justice Davis Hunt sentenced him to 24 years with a minimum of 18 years. Because Vinette's life obviously meant nothing. Arthur's sentence becomes finalised in May 2021, and Arthur has now been granted parole, yet again, and is due to be released sometime between the 5th of November and 25th of November this year. Whoops-a-days, he has now been released. He was released on the 12th of November.
Mm.
He is 75 years old and now identifies as a transgender person. See, I'm talking about Reginald Tex Arthur, who now goes by the name Ms. Arthur, and is preparing to undergo a sex change as soon as possible. He would like the operation to be funded by Medicare, the Australian free medical system. However, this has come under fire from many parties, making headlines in the Australian tabloids. Her new name is Ms. Arthur, and her whereabouts is also unknown. It's also been reported that after the murder of Vinette, a photograph of Arthur was found with her wearing her victim's dress and a wig in a sexual pose. You can see this in the show notes, along with many other photographs of Arthur and That's her many victims.
Wearing other people's clothes that you've murdered.
Yeah.
I don't like that.
On her camera.
Yeah.
Pictures on her camera. The New South Wales State Parole Authority have stated that they have to release her now so that they are able to monitor her. Rather than wait for the sentence to finish and then she would walk out of jail with no supervision or monitoring. This is despite the fact that Arthur Orr has killed twice after being released from prison on previous offences.
Mm. Yep.
The State Parole Authority have denied her parole 4 times in the past. However, they have no choice but to let her out now so that they can monitor her.
Crazy.
Arthur will have to adhere to electronic monitoring, psychological programs, and abstain from alcohol.
I would say that she needed that a long time ago.
I read the words, he was born a psychopath and he'll always be a psychopath. I believe this to be true. Bennett's brother and most vocal advocate for her is sharing concerns that this monster will kill again.
Mm.
I guess only time will tell. So be careful out there. You never know who you're standing next to at the supermarket. Or whom you're passing on the road. And in this case, you actually have no idea. She could be living next door. She was released days ago on the 12th of November. So if you've got a new neighbour, have a good look.
That's why I don't trust anyone.
Yep.
Don't stop for anyone and, yep.
Don't trust anyone.
Don't trust anyone.
Ms. Arthurl is now being investigated for allegedly threatening to blow up the New South Wales Police Headquarters.
That's so casual.
Interesting. And for threatening to kill a member of Annette's family.
Oh, okay.
There are a number of photos of Miss Arthurl and her victims in the show notes, along with credits. So please view the show notes. So what did you think of that, Kim?
That was absolutely crazy.
How amazing that in this day and age you can kill 3 people that they know of and not serve a single life sentence.
Insane.
It is.
Crazy.
Absolutely. All right. What are you going to be doing?
Well, I have chosen the Nowra bodies in the barrels.
Oh my gosh. I used to live in Nowra.
Well, not in Nowra, but
very close.
Yes.
All right. Let's get started.
Okay. So, at about 2:30 on January of 2006, on the 29th, approximately 10 hours before the bodies were discovered, Stacey Lee Caton, who was 27 at the time, walked into the Nowra police station. This is where he told police that there was a woman and a man who were tied up in a house on Kalamea Street, telling the police that he feared that they would be killed.
Holy crap!
Yes.
Oh my god.
Lee Caton later stated that, I quote, "I can't live with that on my conscience," end quote. But there was far more to the story.
Ooh.
So, in 2006, Nowra had approximately 28,000 people. The area is well known for farming. There are lots of dairies, wineries, and the region also produces tons of silage, which was great when we had cows. There are great walks and lookouts, and holidays is packed with tourists.
Nowra is incredible for tourists.
Yeah,
we have the best beaches, the best rivers.
Yep.
Like the Shorehaven is incredible. So anybody looking for a tourist destination, Shorehaven.
I was going to say, a trip that usually takes about 10 minutes could take up to 45 in, like, holidays. Nowra is remembered for a different reason. Ask most people who live in Nowra about Kalamea Street, and they probably be able to tell you about the bodies in the barrels. On the same day...
Bodies? Yes, in barrels?
Yes.
Oh, my God. Go on.
On the same day that Stacey Lee Caton walked into the police station, a husband and wife were cycling through the Tomorong State Forest, which is not far from Nowra, just off Jervis Bay Road. As they were riding, they started to smell smoke, which is obviously a huge thing because, well, bushfires. Everyone in Australia knows bushfires are horrible. It was also summer and well into the bushfire season at this point. As they rode closer, they realised the source of where the smoke was emanating from. They called the authorities, and when the rural fire service had extinguished the flames, they could see 2 large barrels. The worst part was when they saw inside the barrels and realised that there was human remains inside.
Oh my gosh, that's awful.
I could not imagine that smell and that sight and just living with that, being there. Okay, so Kim Snimson was born in New Zealand on the 30th of July, 1970. She had moved to South Australia when she was 5 and had moved around quite frequently. At one point, she had been allegedly being sexually assaulted by a friend of the family, but I couldn't find much on that. And apparently, Kim had left home by 15 and she did not finish her high school.
Mm-hmm.
Kim was now 36 and a mother of 2 daughters, was regarded as an easygoing, smart lady who loved dogs and horses, and she was the owner of the Kalamea Street house.
Mm.
She had moved to the house on Kalamea Street in 2001. She had a pretty rocky marriage with an army officer, and in 2005 they broke up. He was then posted to Wodonga. He took their 2 daughters with him, and in order to mend her marriage, she moved to Wodonga with him and their daughters. But things didn't go well, and after about 2 weeks, she drove back to Nowra, taking the girls with her.
Oh, that's so sad.
While she had been away, she had rented her house out to her next-door neighbour, Stacey Lee Caton, and he would take care of her animals for her. He had grown up in a religious household and in his teens had started to rebel. This resulted in him leaving home when he was just 14, which is incredibly young. He moved in with his sister and did some labouring jobs. After a bit, he decided to move back home, but obviously that wasn't a good situation for him, and he decided to move out again, and he moved in with some friends in Sydney. In 1996, he had an accident on a motorbike where he sustained a head injury.
Oh.
It also resulted in the death of his passenger, who had actually been his best friend at the time.
Oh, that must have been awful.
Well, these events led to him having, headaches, mood swings, and pretty bad depression. Him admit, but you're not going to feel sorry for them for very long.
I thought he might be in the barrel.
No. Him had moved to Nowra after she inherited the Kalamea Street house. He had some horses, which she kept at the farm, called Champagne Shires, but she soon fell behind in payments, so she was allowed to work at the farm, pay some of it off. The farm where Kim kept her horses, Champagne Shires, was owned by Catherine McKay and Gregory Hoser. This is who the bodies were revealed to be.
Oh.
At the time of the murders, Gregory Hoser was 56 and Catherine McKay was 44.
Oh.
The damage done to the bodies was so bad that they could not determine the cause of death.
Oh my God, what did they do to deserve that?
The couple were well-liked and, by all accounts, outstanding members of the community. They were loving parents of a 10-year-old son, and Catherine had always loved horses and had been a part of the pony club when she was young. Greg had worked at the Sydney Water Board and had retired.
So sad.
They were very community-focused and loved giving back, being members of and donating to Shoalhaven Emergency Services, the Nowra Show Society, the Bulambi Surf Life Saving Club, the YWCA, the Shire Horse Society of Australia, and the Shoalhaven Hospital, where Catherine had worked as a nurse.
So they were just generally great people.
Yeah, decent, nice people. As usual.
As usual.
Yeah, always. Kim alleges that she had an affair with the husband, Gregory Hoser. There is no evidence to support this, but that it had ended when she received a tape in 2005, which she said depicted the couple having sex with her while she was drugged or drunk. This is what she told Lee Caton. In another conversation, this time with another friend, Andrew Fletcher, she had said that it had been her daughters who had been sexually assaulted and videotaped. On the 28th of January, 2006, Kim's plan was set into motion. She had dropped off one of her daughters with a friend and the other daughter off with some friends called Andrew and Darlene Fletcher. His and Kim's daughters were good friends and they would often have each other's children over. She had then gone to see Lee Caton, reminded him of the tape of her and asked if he would be willing to beat up the couple. He agreed. She then went to pick up Andrew, who had also agreed to help. Fletcher said he felt disgusted because it involved a child and that I didn't mind putting them on the ground and holding them down while they were tied up because they were rock spiders, which essentially means pedophiles, which there was no evidence for. Kim had told him this version about her daughters, knowing it would compel him to help, as he was a family man.
She was very manipulative, wasn't she?
Very, very, and you'll see this further down. This was the first time that the two men had met, and they also had never met Catherine or Gregory. Oh, they had never met these people, and they were willing to help bash them.
And just listen to that crazy woman.
Yeah. Simpson called Gregory at about 4:59 p.m., and they were said to be talking about horses. He then asked him to come around. And a few moments later, he arrived in his Hilux.
No.
As he walked inside, he unfortunately was ambushed. Lee Kate alleges that Flincher had been wearing a beanie, which he made into a makeshift balaclava, and had hit Gregory over the head with a block of wood. But Flincher alleges that it was Lee Caton who had hit him.
Because they're both heroes.
So, I don't know. I think it was Lee Caton, but they kind of turned on each other, so no one. I don't know.
Absolutely.
I couldn't find any of who definitively had done it. Gregory was then forced onto the ground and then tied up. While he pleaded with them to stop, he was told that this was happening because he touched kids.
Ugh.
And at this point, a flaw in Kim's story was shown, but either Stacey didn't realise or was caught up or just didn't hear it because they did not stop.
That's terrible. That poor man.
I know. That's crazy. And you'd be thinking at this point,
I've never touched a kid. Done that. Yeah. Please.
Like, why are you doing this? Because they hogtied him and then Kim gagged him, shoving socks into his mouth, and then she put tape over it. And then they just dragged him into the bathroom and left him there.
So sad.
Yeah. And then at 5:26 p.m., she called, like, Kim called Catherine and asked her to come over. Quote, settle your husband down. Catherine then arrived a few moments later. It is alleged then that Flincher was the one who tackled her to the ground. But he also alleges that it had been Lee Kate. They both were, like, throwing each other under the bus, so.
That's losers.
Yeah. They then hogtied her, gagged her, left her on the floor of the kitchen.
And that's just awful.
Yeah. And I'm glad at this point that their little son, like their 10-year-old son, had been with relative.
Yeah.
Because, like, he would have been at home by himself otherwise, or who knows, she would have taken him with her. Like,
yeah.
Like, it's sad, but lucky he wasn't there. So at about 5:30, Snibson and Flincher left to go drop Catherine's car back at Champagne Shires. And then they left to get cleaning supplies because as they had hit Gregory's head, he had left blood in the house. Then they were spotted at the South Narrow Servo buying cleaning products, which is where, if I go to South Narrow, I get fuel.
Me so, too.
It's kind of disturbing. While they were gone, Lee Caton was watching the victims. And then when Snibson and Flincher arrived, the three of them started cleaning up the mouth. There was blood everywhere. Simpson then reportedly wrapped tape around Catherine's head, covering her airways, and watched until she asphyxiated.
No way.
Yep, they just sat there and watched.
No, that's awful.
She then went and got some electrical fence wiring. Okay, this is really bad. Rolled a noose and killed Gregory by standing on his back and pulling upwards.
Oh, that's disgusting.
They then got the barrels out of the back of Snibson's car, which he had taken from Champagne Shires. They then put the bodies of Catherine and Gregory inside the barrels. So she literally got the barrels from their own farm and put them in them. Once it was dark, they drove out of Nowra, driving towards this Tomorong State Forest, roughly 15 kilometres away, where they took the barrels out of the car and doused them in petrol, and then Snibson lit them on fire.
Ugh, that is dreadful.
They also took Gregory's Hilux out to Braidwood Road near HMAS Albatross and set that on fire too. Although, I don't know what it is about Braidwood Road. Everyone sets fires alight there.
All the cars.
All of them. Yes.
Yeah.
Lee Caton also alleges that around midnight they went back to the forest as Snibson wanted to, quote, see if the bodies were burnt.
Ugh.
No. So that there would be no DNA.
She's so nasty.
Mm-hmm.
So un-everything. Mm-hmm. She's disgusting. Ugh.
Kim Snibson, 36, was arrested around 8 a.m. and the police found two petrol cans in the back of her vehicle. Stacey Lee Caton, 27, and Andrew Flincher, 31, were also arrested.
Good.
In the trial, Kim tried to make out that she feared Caton and that he was the one who was in charge. Luckily, the judge saw right through that. As the judge said, that, quote, that there was no conceivable basis upon which her culpability could be reduced because she was in some way acting under duress from Lee Caton, and that her story and allegations didn't contain a shred of truth. Justice Bowden described various elements of her versions of events. They were totally defenseless and at the mercy of the offender. Quite fanciful and elaborately designed piece of fiction. Kim Snibson, 38, was sentenced to 32 years with a 24-year non-parole period. For the kidnapping, she was sentenced to 8 years, and for murders, she was sentenced to 26 years. And she will be eligible for parole in 2030.
Wow.
Yep. Stacey Lee Caton, 29, pleaded guilty to kidnapping and murder and is serving 22 years with 16 non-parole periods.
So he's probably out now.
Yeah, probably.
Wow. That's incredible.
Andrew Wayne Flincher, 33, is serving a 10-year sentence with a non-parole period of 7 years and was acquitted of murder.
So he's definitely out.
Yeah.
Well, these people are walking amongst us.
Miss Keeley, Catherine's sister, said that their father, aged in his 80s, was not coping with the death and was waking up in the middle of the night thinking of how his youngest daughter had died. She also said that her sister and brother-in-law were soulmates. Marion Mackay, another sister, said, "I am struggling to find the words for the numbness and traumatic feeling the murder caused the family." Okay. Well, there is a little bit of a twist.
Ooh.
This is not the first time Snibson had tried to get what she wants by forceful and unjust means.
Ooh, do tell.
There were many accusations that came out about her. One of Snibson's friends had given evidence that in 1997, when she was living in Sydney, she had planned to murder her elderly neighbour. And after moving to Kalamea Street, Nowra Hill in 2001, Snibson offered another friend $30,000 to make sure the elderly lady across the road died.
My goodness!
You know, this lady was Judith Kalinkas, a lovely lady who bred dogs. She died less than 2 years later of bowel cancer. The weird thing is who she left her house and animals to. As you have probably guessed, it was Kim Snibson. Despite the fact of having many living relatives. Snibson had said, "I didn't ask her to do it."
No.
Not to mention the fact that she had only changed her will the night before.
What?
Yes. So Kim had got her to change her will pretty much so that she inherited.
That is horrific.
Yep. And we actually, my sister knows someone who actually lives in the Kalamea Street house now.
Yes, she does.
Yep.
And I'm going there because I want to take photos.
Well, I remember hearing about this, but I was in year 6 back then when it actually happened. But I remember, like, really hearing about it when the trials were on, like, 2008. And then I was fascinated by how someone could do such an unthinkable crime. Crazy.
And as a mother, I just thought, my goodness, this could happen to anyone.
Yep.
You know,
over such a stupid thing just because she fell behind in payments and she actually wanted the couple, Gregory Hoser and Catherine Mackay, to
sign over their property.
Sign over their property. Yeah.
Yeah. That was part of what she wanted to do.
That's just crazy.
Yeah. That is
how awful. Do you do that to someone? For such a stupid reason because she just wants what she wants.
But justice has been served.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. You can follow us at
Facebook at Solved, Unsolved or Spooky, on Twitter at hashtag or Solved, Instagram at Solved, Unsolved or Spooky. You can email us at podcast@solvedunsolvedorspooky.com. Please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes.